This is David Duke, and welcome to the audio version of My Awakening. This is part four, the fight for the truth. And I'd like to remind you that this book is free, and I urge you to upload it on your websites, to put it on peer networks, and make this book available to as many people as possible. I also urge you to understand that many, many years of research and study went into this book, and thousands of hours went into crafting it and putting it together and proofreading and all the other things that go into a book of this depth and scope. And hundreds of hours were employed in making this free copy. So I hope that if you find this book valuable and important, that you support my work and you support getting this book out. Also, I urge you to get the hardback edition. It's a beautifully bound hardback edition of the book. You can order it from my office at davidduke.com. And from the office, it's good. It has a very good discount. And all the books that we send from my office are, in fact, autographed, which makes it a lot more valuable. I urge you to order your own hardback copy. It's got great index. The book is compartmentalized, so you can study any particular area you want of study and use that for your conversations or for your discussions with your friends and family. And I must tell you that the book is important for helping you to bring other people, your friends and your family and other associates into line and awakened as to these issues and ideas. It's very difficult sometimes converting a friend or family member because they say, oh, that's just George, or that's just my son, or that's just my father, whatever. But when you bring them into a book and you get them wrapped up into the character of a book, which I guess is my character and my history and the interesting aspects of my life, they get a new perspective. And if you can just finally convince your relative to read the book or listen to the book, I think that makes a big impact. So I hope a lot of you listen to this broadcast. Make sure that you order the book in hardback, order multiple copies for your friends and family, and thankfully, and I appreciate it if you give us some support for this important work. So we begin with Chapter 28, My Beginning, Activism. In 1966, my father was hired as an engineer for the U.S. Agency for International Development in Vietnam. As I prepared to enter my junior year in high school, he felt it would be better for me to attend military school while he was overseas. Although I wanted to follow in my father's footsteps and eventually serve in the military and become an officer, I did not want to leave New Orleans. He enrolled me in Riverside Military Academy, as he thought my mother's illness would prevent her from providing me adequate supervision, and of course he'd be halfway around the world during this period. I adjusted unevenly to my new life at Riverside. At home I knew freedom. I could go out into the swamps and forests whenever I wanted, or read late into the night. I could go to the library, swim in the lake, or spend time volunteering at the Citizens Council. With my father often working and my mother mostly bedridden, I had more freedom to control my own time than most boys of my age. All that came to an abrupt end. My loss of freedom at military school hit me hard. The school tried to control as much of the students' time as it could in order to keep us out of trouble. In the regular military, one could get a pass or furlough for a few days. But military school, it seemed that there was never an escape from the regimen. Reveille came at 6:30 a.m., lights out at 10:30. We had inspections before breakfast, after breakfast, before supper, and again after supper. There were study periods, athletics, and drills. Time seemed to grind away in boring rituals of meaningless activity. I always used my Saturday pass, and while most of my buddies usually went to town, I usually headed for the beauty of Lake Lanier and its surrounding mountains. The Louisiana Bayou country gave me an intimacy with the great variety of life found in nature, but the mountains of North Georgia gave me a different view of nature. They rekindled my early memories of the Alps and the trips our family took to America's national parks. The mountains were so different from the humid marshes back home. In the forests and swamps, I could seldom see farther than just a few hundred feet. Even on clear nights, the ambient lights of New Orleans dimmed the stars, making them seem distant and unreal. On the other hand, when climbing in the hills of North Georgia, I could see for miles in the crisp air of autumn. In the evening, the stars seemed close enough to touch, almost as close as the leaves of the live oak trees back home. It seemed as though I could climb into the stairway of the Milky Way as I had the branches of those oaks. That fall, the wilds of North Georgia also gave me a show of the most vivid autumn colors I'd ever seen, and painted them in heroic scale on the sweep and grandeur of the mountains. As the wetlands made me focus on the varied forms of life and the love that springs from it, the mountains and stars inspired me. Inspired me with a sense of the awesome power of nature and the call of the infinite. After the initial rebelliousness in me had been broken, I adapted quite well to the discipline at Riverside. I realized that there was a relation between discipline and honor. For discipline is ultimately exercised in the power of one's word. I learned lessons that have stayed with me all my life. I learned to do what I had to do rather than what I wanted to do at the moment. And I learned that complaining or whining about unpleasant tasks did no one any good, especially myself. At Riverside, I continued my inquiry into the racial idea. I ordered book after book from Noontide Press, and my favorite publication was Western Destiny, Willis Carto's introduction to Francis Parker Yockey's monumental book, Imperium. It inspired me. Actually, I liked Carto's introduction better than the book itself, for it was a beautifully written, succinct summary of our struggle for Western mankind. I was lucky to have two really fine teachers who were open-minded on the race issue and who willingly read the books on the subject that I brought to them. One was Lieutenant Bell, my history teacher, and the other a brilliant elderly English teacher with an old New York family name of Van Houten, a name he was very proud of. He was one of the few teachers who carried no military rank at the school. While Bell stimulated my love of history, Van Houten focused my attention on the great classics of literature, including the classics of ancient Greece. I stayed long after class on many occasions to discuss a great range of topics, despite our age differences and station. These teachers became my friends and treated me as an intellectual equal. I would often spend a Sunday afternoon or a weekend study period at their offices discussing with them everything that came to mind in the arts and sciences. One of the unique aspects of Riverside is that after Christmas break until Easter, the school would relocate to its campus at Hollywood, Florida. After class, Lieutenant Bell and I would frequently go to the beach, don our scuba, or more often, snorkeling gear, and swim out to the reefs 200 yards offshore. The appreciation for nature that I acquired as a young man in Louisiana bayou country helped me appreciate the wonders of the ocean. Soon I had all sorts of shells and aquatic specimens scattered about my dorm room. The racial truths I had learned fit in perfectly with my love of the natural world. I became aware that there's a difference between observing or enjoying the wonders of nature and being conscious that my genotype was truly a part of nature, an integral part. It became apparent that mankind, like any other living kind of life, must abide by nature's laws if we are to be healthy and fulfilled. When I returned home the next summer, I found the swamps and cypress forests just as beautiful as I had remembered them. On my first day back, I found some heart of palm, caught some fish and crabs, and roasted them all in a shady place. Nothing had tasted so sweet in months. After I had my fill, I stretched out on the grass in the shade of a cypress tree, feeling the beads of perspiration sting my eyes. I thought about the cool breezes that had recently caressed me in the hills and mountains around Gainesville, Georgia, and how much that coolness had exhilarated me. I also thought about the purplish peaks and the rays of sun that broke through the clouds like spotlights raking the mountainsides. Only in the mountains can one really get a sense of the magnificent architectural sweep and power of the earth. I still love the life I found in the swampland, but I came to the realization that I love the aesthetic and power of the mountains even more. And in the mountains, I have since found my greatest inspiration. That summer, I used the experience I gained building houses with my father to land the job working with some local house painters. I also found a sizable paper route opening up in the uptown section of New Orleans. It was about a 15-minute drive from my home in my rickety old Ford Falcon. After a few months on the paper route, I sold the car for a profit. So with my newspaper profits and some of my savings for about $1,200, I bought a 1963 white convertible Ford Galaxy that needed a lot of work. That was an excellent deal in those days. After a month's time, I had it in perfect condition, complete with a new convertible top I had installed myself. Every morning, I would drive to my route about 4 a.m. and throw my 200 newspapers, stopping at the end of each block and walking around it with my bulging paper bag slung from my shoulder. I worked for the same newspaper I despised for its incessant egalitarianism and hypocritical pro-Zionist position. It was the Newhouse-owned Times-Picayune. But strangely, I did not think about the ownership or ideology in connection with my job. There was only one daily in New Orleans, and I delivered papers during a number of periods since the fifth grade. For me, throwing the paper was a way of life, disconnected from its ownership or politics. Winter that year was extremely cold. Remembrances of it comes to me every time a rubber band breaks in my fingers. When the additions ran thick and heavy, the red rubber bands would often pop in the cold temperatures as I stretched them around the thick papers. When they struck my cold fingers, they felt like a bee had stung them. In New Orleans, the humidity makes the summers feel hotter, and the winter nights and early mornings seem colder. In the winter, I shivered, and in the summer, I sweated. But it was a great job for a high school student. I was 17. In 6 months, by the laws of Louisiana, I would be deemed a man. I returned to public high school in New Orleans and attended an integrated school, John F. Kennedy, a newly constructed school of mostly middle to upper income white students near the Pontchartrain lakefront. Kennedy also had about 10% black makeup. Although the numbers of black students were small compared to most New Orleans schools at the time, there were still some serious problems. I had the chance for the first time to observe a number of teenage blacks in a close environment, and it seemed every behavioral trait that I had read about in psychological studies came alive right in front of my eyes. Black girls and boys, on average, were a lot louder than whites. They wore their emotions as flamboyantly as they did the styles of their clothing, and they seemed to oscillate between broad toothy smiles or closed-mouthed frowns. When they became upset or angry, their nostrils would flare like a bull ready to charge. Even though their anger was a terrible sight to behold, their temperament seemed more jovial on average than morose, and the hallways often reverberated with black girls or boys singing or chanting some jingles that always ended with a slapping of hands and spastic body movements. Academically, most of them performed poorly, but I do remember one black girl in my civics class whom I thought was an excellent student. In sports, they excelled in numbers far disproportionate to their percentage of the student body. and the coaches energetically recruited them for the athletic teams. A friend who had a large paper route he was giving up offered it to me. I ambitiously added 225 new newspaper deliveries to my own 200. My first day with it fell on a rainy Sunday morning. I found it difficult to both read my address sheet and make out the house numbers in that cold, dark, wet morning. To compound my troubles, I'd gone out the night before to a drive-in theater with a girlfriend from school, and I didn't get home until after midnight. I arose at 2 a.m. so I could handle the new route. At about 7 a.m., completely exhausted and cold, I started the drive home with my warm heater buzzing in my automobile. I had nodded off driving once or twice on previous occasions, but an internal alarm always woke me up, and the adrenaline rush kept me alert the rest of the way home. On that Sunday morning, when I dozed off, I nearly never woke up again. Coming off the New Orleans Pontchartrain Expressway onto Lakeshore Boulevard, the road curved a little to the left while I kept going straight at 45 miles per hour. I struck an 8-foot diameter oak tree that didn't give an inch when my Galaxy hit it head on. My head and body broke through the steering wheel, and my head shattered through the windshield and back. I ended up slumped over the steering column, pieces of the steering wheel lying in my lap. I remember nothing about the accident other than the blood soaking my shirt, how it had turned cold, and I remember hands pulling my body out of the wreckage and loading me into an ambulance for the trip to Ochsner Foundation Hospital. After a few hours, my face had begun to swell to the point that I could barely peer out of my eyes, and the doctors had suspicion of internal bleeding. After the extreme discomfort of my introduction to a urinary catheter, the doctors were surprised that there were no signs of blood. I did, however, have a crushed nose and chin, an 8-stitch cut on the right side of my upper lip, as well as a concussion. I stayed in the hospital for the rest of the day, and then they sent me home. With my father in Vietnam and my mother in poor health, I tended to myself for the most part. However, my girlfriend, Evelyn, came over to nurse me a little during the next week, while I remained out of school. When she first came into my room and saw my head swollen like a huge turnip, my forehead and cheeks so swollen that they almost obscured the sight of my eyeballs, she burst out into tears. Of course, her reaction helped neither of us feel any better. The policeman who pulled me from the car came by to visit. He told me that he'd seen a lot of car wrecks and was surprised that I had survived. He said that he had first expected to find me decapitated when he arrived on the scene and saw the smashed windshield. I can still remember even feeling as bad as I did talking to him about the race problem. It was a subject I always managed to bring up. While at home, I continued to read despite some blurred vision, but finally I put down my books and just closed my eyes. I thought deeply about my beliefs. I realized that the racial concepts I read about and understood were not just some sort of intellectual game without any practical meaning for the real world. Racial dynamics constituted the essence of both mankind's history and its future. Our race faced the greatest genetic danger of its long history. Because of our non-sustaining birth rates, our people all over the world were committing race suicide. Even the homelands of our race were being inundated by massive immigration and proliferating non-European genes. Intermarriage was also increasing because of its media fashionableness. I knew our people were liable to be a minority in America and even in our European homelands in a couple of generations. We were in a struggle for our existence. I saw America being rapidly transformed from an extension of European values and culture to one being swamped by the third world. There were no government projections then of non-white American majorities, but all the racial writers I had read saw the coming minority status of whites in America. It would not be until the 1990s that the Census Bureau would confirm a projection of white minority status for 2048. In the Immigration Act of 1965, all the liberal senators swore that the act would have no effect on the ethnic population percentages of the United States. But again, writers such as Drew Smith and others said what the Census Bureau finally admitted 30 years later. On a more visceral level, I saw the destructive changes taking place in our schools, on our streets, in our government, and in the media. An alien wave was sweeping away the values of our forefathers. New Orleans streets were exploding with crime, and the new schools built by ever higher taxes were bright and new on the outside, but mostly full of dull faculty and even duller students on the inside. Welfare financed minority birth rates and non-white immigration strained our social infrastructure to the breaking point, from educational costs to housing, from welfare maintenance to medical care. The resulting economic drain caused a steady decline in living standards for the American middle-class family, forcing both spouses to work, with a devastating impact on both marriages and children. Thousands of white men, women, and children were falling victim to black crime. Crime that swept the major cities almost like a medieval plague. The mass media launched a concentrated attack on the mores of Western civilization and began to glorify wholesale promiscuity, homosexuality, violence, and drug abuse. It was obvious to me that the propaganda would only intensify with time. The quality of elected officials declined with the introduction of vast hordes of minority voters who seldom read anything more intellectual than the television listings, if even that. I saw the handwriting on the American wall, but what was I to do? I was just one 17-year-old high school student. What I did know was that I had to do something. I could not selfishly pursue my own dreams to be a doctor or an astronaut. My race was in the greatest crisis in its long history. I also knew that I could not just continue to sit on the sidelines devouring my books and spreading the racial truth to anyone who came within earshot. I knew that no cause could ever triumph without organization. Ultimately, I looked to history to guide me in the present fight, for I was enthralled by the historical success of the Ku Klux Klan of the Reconstruction South. I wanted to join an organization that stood up for the things I believed. The Citizens Council seemed too passive, for it would not address the issue of Jewish supremacism, even though its leaders were certainly aware of it and talked about it privately all the time. I felt the subject had to be faced. The only group that seemed to stand up forthrightly on race was the Klan. The historical Klan I had read about was very different from the Klan image I saw on television and in the movies. The mass media presented the Klan as nothing but a collection of ignorant, green-teethed, violent Southerners who would just as easily lynch a black man as look at one. I rejected that image because I knew then that the Klan's fundamental recognition of racial differences, although categorized by the media as false, actually was scientifically correct. By almost any measure, races are unequal in mental ability, and this difference is clearly a product of genetic makeup rather than poverty or racial suppression. As for the Jewish extremists, Klansmen understood that, as a group, they were the real supremacists and that they were the driving force of one-world egalitarianism and multiculturalism and globalism, while they maintained a hypocritical doctrine of ethnic superiority and separateness for themselves and for their beloved Israel. True, some Klansmen little understood the genetic or psychological evidence on the race issue. Few were well educated on the historical aspects of the Jewish extremist ethnic war against Western mankind and our religious and cultural institutions. But the ones I came in contact with were overwhelmingly good people, mostly hardworking, church-going, family men. A high proportion had farms or small businesses, and in their self-discipline and responsibility for themselves and their families, they also took responsibility for the society in which they lived. In the heavily black-populated Deep South, they made close observations of the black race that conflicted with the egalitarian dogma of the media, and they trusted their senses and their own experiences rather than the media-concocted image. They thought for themselves. The next section is the historical record. Even before I met my first Klansman, I had already read both the northern and southern views of the radical reconstruction of the South. Though there were hardly any books in print in the 1960s supporting the southern viewpoint, I found many in the libraries, written in earlier decades, that showed the corruption and destructive qualities of the so-called Reconstruction period. From about the turn of the century until after the Second World War, most histories of the period depicted Reconstruction as a regressive, corrupt period that ended only after the success of groups such as the Ku Klux Klan. The popularity of that view is illustrated by the two most watched movies of the 20th century, Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. They both depicted black Reconstruction as a violent and corrupt period. In contrast to the modern historical portrayal of the Klan, Birth of a Nation presented an unapologetic, heroic image of the Klan, and Gone with the Wind presented an image of heroic Southern resistance against the evils of Reconstruction. At the close of the War for Southern Independence, the South was treated like a conquered province. Any Southerner who served in any civil government or in the ranks of the Confederate Army, constituting most white males of the South, was disfranchised. No women's suffrage existed at that time, so the great majority of Southerners were denied the vote. Blacks who were nearly all illiterate and who had little experience with running either businesses or government were suddenly given the right to vote. Opportunities for corruption were rife under those circumstances. Carpetbaggers swarmed into the South to exploit the easily corruptible black vote for their own gain. The Southern brand of such scoundrels, the scalawags, also exploited both the newly franchised Negroes and the prostrate white Southerners. Rapacious taxes destroyed productive Southern families and transferred vast amounts of property to corrupt officials. Black crime ravaged both towns and the countryside, while newly constituted black juries routinely freed those guilty of horrible atrocities against whites. Illiterate and venal elected officials who flaunted their corruption had flooded the Southern legislatures. The black and radical-controlled Louisiana legislature, for example, appropriated $10,000, a huge sum for those times, for cigars and whiskey. Into this maelstrom rode the Ku Klux Klan, a secret organization dedicated to the restoration of Western civilization in the prostrate South. Well-educated men in Pulaski, Tennessee, formed it first as a social club. From their knowledge of Greek, they called their group the Ku Klux Klan, after the word kyklos, meaning circle or assembly. They adopted the traditional garb of the Christian aesthetics, which is still maintained, by the way, in Spain and other countries, who wore the peaked hoods to symbolize doing good works in anonymity. When the superstitious blacks mistook the robed Klansmen for the ghosts of Confederate soldiers, the costumes became a powerful psychological weapon. An oft-repeated story is told of an incident in which a black was accused of burning some barns near the Klan headquarters in Pulaski, Tennessee. He was visited one moonlit night by the eerily clad, white-robed horses and men. Under the speaker's robe was a rubberized tube leading to a treated pouch. He demanded his frightened host bring him a pail of water. The Klansman would then appear to drink the entire bucket of water, saying that this was his, quote, first drink since the Battle of Shiloh. It is said that the Negro never again was suspected of any further mischief. The legendary Confederate general Nathan Bedford Forrest, who pioneered modern guerrilla warfare tactics and who had the distinction of never having lost a battle, all the while in an army that had lost a war, became the first Grand Wizard of the organization. When radical Republicans outlawed the group by federal law, in a tactical maneuver, General Forrest formally disbanded the Klan, knowing that it would simply continue on the local level wherever it was needed. More than 500,000 Southerners joined in the Reconstruction era Klan, making it a veritable secret army against radical Reconstruction. Mere possession of a Klan robe could be punished by death in this period, yet the Klan, state by state, quietly overthrew the black Reconstruction governments. Within 20 years of the Klan's founding, practically the entire South had become free from black and radical Republican control. Because of the terribly bitter feelings generated by the radicals in the Republican Party during the period, the South remained solidly Democratic for 100 years until Republicans such as Barry Goldwater and others announced their opposition to forced integration and reverse discrimination under the so-called Civil Rights Act. In the period following Reconstruction, the American people, along with the federal government, eventually came to understand that the Klan was right, and the 1896 Plessy v. Ferguson Supreme Court decision upheld racial segregation in the South and elsewhere. Birth of a Nation, which portrayed the successful KKK as reuniting North and South as one nation of white brotherhood, was so well received that it spawned what is commonly called the Second Era Klan. It became one of the most powerful American social organizations of the 20th century. At its height, it garnered millions of members, with many becoming U.S. senators, congressmen, and state governors in both the North and the South. Upon a special showing of Birth of a Nation in the White House, President Woodrow Wilson effusively praised the Klan for saving civilization in the South and thus preserving it for all of America. Here is a quote from him from History of the American People. Quote, "Adventurers formed out of the North, as much an enemy of one race as the other, to coerce, beguile, and use the Negroes. In the villages, the Negroes were the office holders, men who knew nothing of its use of authority except its insolence. The policy of the congressional leaders wrought a veritable overthrow of civilization in the South. In their determination to put the white South under the heel of the black South, the white men were roused by the mere instinct of self-preservation, until at last there had sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan, a veritable empire of the South to protect the Southern country." Unquote. That's by the famous President Woodrow Wilson. To illustrate the universally expressed high esteem for the Ku Klux Klan, the Encyclopedia Britannica, in a turn-of-the-century edition, characterized the Reconstruction KKK as a chivalrous organization. The article begins by stating, quote, "Ku Klux Klan is the name of an American secret organization of Southern whites united for self-protection and to oppose the Reconstruction measures of the United States Congress. It ascribes the reasons for the Klan's rise as, quote, the absence of stable government in the South for several years after the Civil War, the corrupt and tyrannical rule of the alien, renegade, and Negro, the disfranchisement of whites, the disarming of whites, outrages of white women by Negro men, unquote. Encyclopedia Britannica, friends. The reborn Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of the 20s, much like the Klan of Reconstruction, had a membership that included the most educated and prominent elements of society, but this time of both North and South. In its heyday, its successful recruitment strategy was to enlist the leaders of the community in business, education, politics, and the Christian church. Compared to the Reconstruction Klan, which had no anti-Catholic bias and had some entirely Catholic units in South Louisiana and a few other areas, the Klan of the 20s capitalized on the fear among the Protestant clergy of the growing Roman Catholicism fueled by massive waves of immigration. In the third era of the Klan of the 1950s and 60s, Protestants still dominated the Klan in the largely non-Catholic South, but most Klan groups discarded anti-Catholicism and saw the need for white Christian unity in response to Jewish supremacism and anti-Christianism. In heavily Catholic South Louisiana, membership in my Klan was mostly Catholic, reflecting the general population. In recent years, some national Klan organizations have even had Catholic leaders. Immigration concerns fueled Klan growth in the 1920s, and when the Restrictionist Acts of the 1920s caused immigration to dwindle, the Klan's appeal lessened. Also, growing Jewish media power launched a propaganda war against the Klan, consistently portraying Klansmen as evil characters and portraying any individual Klan member who broke the law as typical of all Klansmen. Some independent Klan organizations had continued unbroken and little change from Reconstruction, passed down from father to son. Others fell under the umbrella of the 1920s Klan and adopted its unique titles and rituals, along with religious beliefs which differed from the original Ku Klux Klan. Most Klans of the 1920s evolved into more of a social club than a revolutionary organization. Although the violence necessary in the Reconstruction period was not condoned in the present, some Klansmen did respond aggressively to particularly heinous crimes, especially when the victims were women and children. Lynchings and beatings were not limited to black lawbreakers. However, the criminal justice system during that period seldom dealt with wife abuse, but the Klan had a code of chivalry that held sacred the sanctity of womanhood and motherhood. They viewed the physical violation of women as the most terrible of crimes. A drunken bout of white wife beating by a white man could be punished by a small group of concerned citizens, sometimes Klansmen, who gave the abuser a taste of what he'd given his wife. Klansmen of that period would be shocked that in our tolerant society there are such frequent attacks against women and that non-whites now rape more than 20,000 white women each year in the United States. They could not have imagined the growing physical abuse of women in Western nations, increasingly like that of the Third World. The Third Klan era arose in the late 1950s when the Civil Rights Movement overturned a social system that had lasted for centuries. Thousands of independent Klan groups sprang up across the South and in all parts of the United States. The Klan name and symbols had been in the public domain for many years, so no group could claim exclusive use of them. As a result, many different Klan groups sprang up with widely varying philosophies and tactics. There were the U.S. Klans, the United Klans, the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the Knights of the White Camellia, and many simply called Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Most Klan groups were law-abiding, but some believed that violence was the only way to stop integration. Their violent actions were minor compared to the endemic violence that social equality of the races would unleash, and they could not understand that bloodshed only created sympathy for the enemies that they despised. The media solemnly publicized those cases, never missing the opportunity to portray the opponents of civil rights not only as opposing the principle of liberty, but also as immoral men of brutality and violence. In the name of civil rights for blacks, a social system was overturned that resulted in the loss of civil rights for millions of whites who became victims of black violence and crime. One afternoon at the Citizens Council, I met the Klan leader who came to have a great impact on my life. His name was James Lindsay. He was a fascinating man who led a double life. Lindsay was one of the most successful stockbrokers in New Orleans, having a fine home in the exclusive uptown section of New Orleans. But quietly, he led a dedicated Klan group under the pseudonym Ed White. His organization had members in the states of Texas, Tennessee, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. He put me in touch with a couple of students at Kennedy High School whose fathers were active in a Klan den. Lindsay told me that illegality and violence would not be tolerated in our group, and he repeatedly pointed out that much of the violence in some of the other Klans around the country had been instigated by government agent provocateurs. The federal government, he contended, encouraged violence as a means to destroy the Klan, and at the same time to discredit and make our cause appear immoral in the eyes of the public. Years later, when the U.S. Congress had hearings on the federal government program called COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Program, it discovered that the federal government had done exactly what Lindsay claimed, that its agents had promoted violence and illegality among both right-wing and left-wing groups as a means of destroying their viability. I was invited to a small meeting, and Lindsay gave a brief but moving speech describing his love of our heritage and country. He passionately spoke of the dire fate that awaited us if the Anglo-Saxon became overwhelmed by the masses of the Third World. Lindsay not only was savvy at business and very well read, but he had distinguished himself as a boxing champion while in the U.S. Navy. He was well-spoken, sincere, and had the heart of a boxer who never gives up, even when far behind in the final rounds. He was a man of the world, and with my father halfway around the world, Lindsay became much like a second father to me. I also admired how Lindsay did his Klan work in spite of the risk it posed to his social standing in business. It was interesting how deftly he moved between both worlds. From the minute we met, and he saw the depth of my knowledge and commitment. He taught me about the intricacies and psychology of people, and he helped to sharpen my racial education and rough knowledge to a smooth edge. Finally, the important day came. In a room lit only by flickering white candles on a wooden cross, with white-robed men standing at attention, I approached the altar where lay a sword and a Bible open to the book of Romans. There I took a sacred oath to my Christian faith, to America, to the Constitution of the United States, to the white race, and to my Klan brethren. I swore to always protect the sanctity of womanhood, to protect the innocent, to protect the elderly, and the ultimate treasure of our people, the children. Just to be sure that every Klansman in his organization knew clearly our position on violence, Lindsay also required each Klansman to swear in his sacred oath that he would not conspire to commit any illegal acts of violence. And that was a section that remained in the oath of my Klan during my entire tenure. From the time when I first joined this Klan organization to the time when I resigned from the organization years later, no member of my Klan organization had ever committed an illegal, violent act against a racial minority. Even the ADL in their attacks against me in later years grudgingly admitted that my Klan was entirely nonviolent. Of course, to them, our strict legality simply made us a more dangerous element than other Klans because we were more able to influence the public and the political process. The next chapter is chapter 29, An LSU White Tiger.